Welcome to the story of Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop. This is Chapter 17, A Good Month of Hard Work. The Salmons have heard there's a drain on the shop's power and need to go about finding it. I'm the author, Ray DeBicke, happy to read this story to you. Let's do the novel equivalent of a training montage. You can join Millie Salmon on Patreon or find more at milliesalmon.com. And you can follow this podcast and other stories on social media at Infinite Shop Limited. Chapter 17, A Good Month of Hard Work. Grandpa. At this point, he'd been called it long enough by enough very different people that he'd taken it on as his name. Though there was the occasional Mrs. Pitters who would always call him Master Pilling, and that was fine since Mrs. Pitters was allowed to call anyone what she wanted. She earned it through a long life of speaking honestly. It was a slow Sunday evening. Grandpa was on his stool behind the counter of the shop. With few customers, the room was set up like many a night he remembered, with Jules and Stoney poring over the hard numbers coming into the persistence engine that they had built. The display, embedded in the counter, was clear of all the pretend notes and sales tax tables. It was now running at full power with the live data from the machine room. Benji had been away a long time. Stoney regularly visited the shop, but just as a shop, and a weekly commute to work on Dalibertor. There was a new addition. Millie was next to Grandpa. She leaned over the counter, as intent as her father and intense as her mother. Grandpa could not be more pleased. After 13 Earth years, they were back. "We now have the parameters," Jules said. He was leaned forward over the large display with his nose almost brushing the numbers. "What are they?" Stoney was standing away, taking the larger view of the screen with arms folded. It was like a game between the two of them, never making the same pose at the same time. She assessed the bigger picture. "It looks like someone is plugging a new shop into ours. Same chart of ramping up, same levels at the engine, as if it were a cell dividing itself. But the way it's tripping these loops," Jules pointed at the cluster of graphs closest to him, "we're only seeing two new tethers. They're going from nowhere and to nowhere, but they're definitely there. These random outputs wouldn't be engaged if someone were making a new shop. It's something vastly weirder than just a copy." The ever-present argument. Stoney cutting it down for the simplest explanation. Jules for the most bizarre. Always pulling to the direction the other needed to go. "That," Stoney waved at the complex but unattached loops that were causing Jules issues. "That doesn't look like anything more than a regular little hack attack. Something coming in from somewhere else, independent of the larger drain on the persistence engine." Jules pushed away from the counter. "Happening at the same time? And moving closer to each other. The chances of that coincidence are too high. These parts have to fit together." Grandpa felt a stir next to him. There was a crackling energy start to build in Millie, as gears locking into place and putting motion into a carriage. She spoke up. "It looks like pool table balls cracking together to me. Could it be another whole shop is bumping into ours?" She tilted her head, squinted a little, tried to make the errant pictures and graphs focus into something whole. "That's never happened before," Jules said. "It's a good thought, but I'm still not connecting it with these other things happening." There was a small buzz next to Grandpa, as the Malpore machine let him know His coffee was ready. He reached under the counter, pulled out the steaming cup, and took a sip. Millie looked a little surprised, like she didn't know there was a food machine stashed there. Of course she didn't. So much had been kept from her over the years. The hot sip jogged something in Grandpa's mind, so he spoke up.
I don't know, Jules. Stoney makes a good point that it could be something simple. And to Millie's point, what's simpler than a collision? There were the Defnaclu of Teleton. They spent their entire civilization's wealth in search of the squeak in their planet's axis.
He sipped his coffee. Dad, I don't think this is a Defnaclu situation. They also invented the galaxy's only economic system based on the exchange of heartfelt holiday cards. They had some very different priorities.
That's weird. Like Christmas cards?
Well, no weirder than pictures of dead presidents, Grandpa said. But it wasn't the cards that made it an unstable system. It was the heartfelt message that gave it value. Most economic systems destruct if poets become the wealthiest folks on the planet. Something about the sincerity of words ruins corporate memos. The Defnaclu ended up being the only people with business school taught entirely in verse.
Again, not a Defnaclu situation, Jules interjected. As tended to happen, Stoney brought the important question to the table. She asked her husband,
What is it you are looking for, Jules?
Some line that gets from here, he waved at the cluster showing the drain on the persistence engine, to here, he waved at the throne switches closest to him.
If there is one, and I'm not saying there is, we would expect to see it where?
Stoney was leading him down a path, her path, one that Grandpa had seen her do in countless earlier discussions like this. But it wouldn't work this time, because Millie wouldn't let it.
I could find it, Millie piped in.
Both parents looked at her. Grandpa smiled over his coffee.
I can plainly see these energy draws here.
Millie turned and manipulated the larger graphs at one corner of the display.
These are the ones that Homie gave to you, Dad. And these are the ones that you got from Tall Burn, Mom.
She swiped to the graphs that Jules was laboring over.
I can also see the things you're talking about, Dad, with these two groups of switches moving around and their rise being more than a coincidence.
She stood straight and addressed her parents.
Let me work in the machine room and see if I can find something.
Stoney and Jules looked at each other, then back at their daughter. Grandpa knew this would be an acceptable arrangement when her mother spoke first.
What will it look like if there is not a connection? Stoney asked.
Millie took a second to consider this.
Right now, these numbers are fluctuating, and these numbers are fluctuating. They look similar, like they can be connected. And they're drifting together. But if they add up on their own separately for a while and their patterns separate, there's probably isn't a connection between them.
I'd like to find a connection, Jules said.
I'd like to find an explanation, Stoney amended pointedly.
I like that you found Millie is ready to do the work, Grandpa offered. You have an outline of what's going on. Time to let Millie take her turn at coloring it in.
Jules nodded at this, and Stoney looked pleased at the idea. They cleared the counter, restored it to its pretend desk appearance, and started gathering coats to head up to the Salmons' apartment for Sunday dinner.
Can I close up with Grandpa?
Millie asked her parents. They assented and left. Grandpa pulled out the thick binder from under the counter with the tasks for the end of that day. It was a short list, replacing a light bulb on the Tuxalone 9 storefront, putting the bathroom supplies back in the storage cabinet, taking down an expired window poster on Sephi Homeworld, advertising a grass dancing festival. It was a little cleaning and a lot of relief, because he was doing it with his granddaughter. She'd been close, but only to a small portion of his life. That curtain was starting to come down, just like this out-of-date poster.
"Grandpa?" Millie asked.
"Yes, Quibby."
"Did the Defnacluse planet actually squeak?"
"Oh, absolutely. Appallingly loud. The ancient galactic civilization that created them and their planet of Tetalon had died off millennia before and stopped oiling it. Of course, being a dead civilization, oiling their greeting card machine was the least of their issues."
So each day before school, Millie went into the shop and up to the machine room. She gazed out on her recollection of Dalibrator that she spoke into existence. From a comfortable seat in the middle of the room, she recorded readings from the different gauges in a black and white marble composition book. Well, they had been gauges in Dad's imagined car. Millie replaced them with towers out the window of the city. Height, window count, color, all told her the data she needed. She left the room, firmly clicking the door behind her. Grandpa saw her out the front door, on Earth, just to make sure. The classes at school were preparing for their spring recitals. Millie would be part of the chorus, backing up the soloists Morgan and Kyle. She genuinely liked the eighth graders and enjoyed listening to them sing, but they picked really dumb songs. Morgan, a viral song that was out of their range, and Kyle got assigned a school standard because they didn't care enough to come up with something more interesting. Millie would do better next year when it was her turn. With Pats and Reggie, their schedule around the neighborhood felt routine and normal and comfortable. Their music lessons, their trips to the shop to pick up a comic book, their Friday boba teas. It was cut a little short because the sun still set pretty early, and it got chilly fast, so there wasn't a lot of time lingering at the park, but it was their afternoons, and it felt good. Back home, up the stairs, into the apartment, the three salmons sat down for dinner. Adequate amounts of still borderline flavors, the dishes migrated away to be replaced with open books and long streams of paper. Dad's laptop would make an appearance, and Millie read off the numbers she recorded in the morning. Then, Mom brought home the new computer. Dad was sounding like they were reaching some limit on the work they were doing. Eventually, Mom convinced him that there would need to be another step if they were going to make a leap in discovering the issue with the shop. Millie realized it may have been Dad really wanting a new computer and setting up Mom to do the convincing. Insightful, Millie thought, and stored this technique for later. Mom took the device out of her bag, and Millie didn't realize it was not a glossy magazine until it was laid flat on the table without pictures or fanfare. Dad opened it like a book and glided a finger over one margin. It wouldn't be fair to call the thing a computer, or even one of the factors that Mom and Dalen carried around Dalibrator. This thing coursed with functionality. Dad's laptop, the day before a top-of-the-line model on Earth, now looked like an unquestionable letdown. It might as well have been a spatula with the ends warped from heat and a little piece of egg right where the flat part met the handle. Millie decided then and there that she would not call this new thing a computer. To her, the thing would forever be the mighty blank. Dad stacked a pile of papers together and sat them on the mighty blank. There was a slightly audible click, and he removed them. He did the same with Millie's composition book that had all the notes and data. Another click. Then his old laptop. Click. The mighty blank had eaten every bit of information. They showed up in a photo spread as very tiny, perfect images of each page, table, and picture. Then Dad started talking. Millie appreciated that he was including her until she realized he wasn't. It wasn't dictation. He was explaining to the computer what the documents were. This was the machine room portable. "Am I supposed to be here for this?" she asked. At Millie's voice, the mighty blank went blank. "Absolutely." The mighty blank took this as authorization to share information with her and recovered its screen. And without asking or being told, Millie knew this fell under the long cape of the shop and the secrets and the twisted space she now occupied. It almost wasn't worth it. Almost. The thing was so cool. But not as cool as the weather, which went from false spring to downright cold. Nice days turned to windy days to bitter, just to remind that winter wasn't officially over. Late evening, Millie was in her room for the tapering beginning of a solid snowstorm. Late in the season, that was when the big ones often came. The first flake landed with soul-saving and school-canceling thud on the window. Millie heard it across the room with her headphones in. Its friends followed quickly after. Millie opened the window a crack. The bubble of warm air from her room extended out for just a second, then collapsed and a ton of cold air rushed in. She closed the window again. The snow was beautiful. She wanted to go down and walk through it. She wouldn't make it through the living room before a parent appeared to ask what she was doing. She took her pillows and stuffed them at the bottom of her door and turned out the lights. Then she opened the window again. The city rode the cold air into her room, and her room became a bubble of the city. Millie put her hands on the ledge and leaned out. She breathed deeply of the air that was being scoured clean by millions of little sponges. It smelled of aluminum, pool water without the chlorine, sitting too close to the air conditioner vent, all the things that were icy and clean and didn't bring to mind the bricks and sidewalk of a damp city. Everything put weight on the city. The people, the cars, the trees, the news. This was just the sky's turn, except the sky's blanket of snow comforted with its heaviness. There was enough powder on the ground that it blunted the hard edges of the concrete world. The city became quiet. All the mean reports and staccato echoes failed to find an edge to bounce off and ran into softness before carrying very far. Sounds, and whatever made them, found themselves alone and stuck in one of the waving drifts that were forming in the streets. The sky was lavender with the lights of buildings reflecting off the low clouds and the lower horizon of the falling flakes. There was depth to the color with a foreground and a background. The streetlights grew halos bright as any saint, throwing light down at the accumulating blanket and up at the trains of flakes riding towards them. Millie pulled back inside a little as a figure came into view. More like he crunched into view, with boots making imprints in the snow. It was a man with an umbrella, but the umbrella was not doing him any good. He had tipped it back and was looking up at the sky, letting the snow fall on his round, bearded face. Millie could see the flakes stuck on the edges of his stubble. The man smiled, not at Millie, just at the world, and meandered up the street. She put her head on her hands on the ledge and just took in the extra coat of color and quiet that her city wore. Millie let the snow accumulate on her hair for a little, feeling each flake and letting them quiet the noisiness of her mind. This was not a problem to be solved, only a scene to be enjoyed. Jules had a routine for the week. There were days with Evan on Monday and Wednesdays. There was cooking with Miss Pitters on Thursdays. There was a great exercise class on Tuesdays and Fridays, which let out in time to see an early movie when they were half-price matinees during the week. He took advantage of that often. Jules also had a routine for each day, but it was more generalized. There was a morning shift, afternoon shift, and an evening shift. That tends to be how parenting goes because nothing with a child in tow ever sticks to an easy hour mark. An explosion out of either end will consume an entire morning or after lunch. So the new routine of evenings around the table with Millie, recording data and comparing notes, was novel and welcome. He took the opportunity to talk about the shape of the shop with Millie, who this evening was offering some of that understanding right back. So the printer, the one I used, the one that you put back in the closet, it has a print head that moves molecules through a dimensional twist in the universe. You can't see it because the 3D print head is coming in from the fourth dimension, so it can print anywhere. Jules felt himself wince. Fourth dimension sounds too science fiction. More like the third and a half dimension? The rules of physics apply, they're just tightly knotted. Millie didn't buy it. But it can print anything, atom by atom, without extending to the actual location. With some very significant limitations. It was something of a protest from Jules, but more of a prompt. It didn't work, so he asked directly, "What are the limitations?" Millie sighed a little, preparing to go into the refrain that Jules had been trying to get into her head for the last few days. "The printer has important limitations on mass and interference," Millie sing-songed. "You can't print poison into someone's vein or gold into a bank vault. The print head cannot go through solids. It cannot go outside the radio range of a tethered door. The print head is most effective injecting few molecules that prompt crystals and polymers to form on their own, which is why it didn't take much to encase the ducts in ultra-hard crystals." She gave him a teen head tilt and half eye roll. "Honestly, that all sounds like phlebotinum preventer, like you invented an anything anywhere generator, but made some bullshit rules to move the plot along." So she was going to teen on a couple levels here. Jules decided to needle back. "It is absolutely fabricated, entirely by my genius self. We're making this artificially difficult so that you can't just print your way into college. Gotta work at that yourself, my dear. And you have discovered that machine can make soap, so be glad it can't print a bar of it to wash out your mouth with that hard language." Jules was pleased with himself. He could see Millie was pleased with her little bit of sass getting under his skin. They sat in a sassed, pleased circle for a moment, more pleased, to be honest. Millie was getting it. "So the print head is what the shop uses to prepare some books for each new customer as they walk into the shop. It's printing on pages, not in books, so not solids." Millie gave it an extra thought. That's also what the mighty blank uses to scan." Jules stopped her. "I wish you wouldn't call this fine device the blank anything. It has a name."
Howard is not the name for a computer, Dad.
Hush with those mean words. Jules picked the tablet supercomputer up to his shoulder like a burping baby. He even patted gently on the back. You will hurt Howard's feelings. He could see Millie was not entirely amused with his antics, but not entirely put off either. She didn't get the giggles like she used to, so Jules had to be satisfied with her dramatic resentment that he was pretty sure passed for amusement in middle school.
Fine, Howard.
She emphasized the second syllable into sounding like word.
Uses the same technique to scan in three dimensions that the printhead uses to print.
That was a solid connection Millie made, and a very correct one, so Jules said so. Really good seeing it that way, Millie, and absolutely right. It's kind of an X-ray, since it can't print inside a solid object. It has a good measure of how solid that object is. That changes between paper and what's written on the paper.
So why don't we use cell phones to transmit data out of the machine room and the shop through the printhead? It can write down all the important data scanned by Howard.
There's actually an easier way. We can just introduce Howard to the persistence engine and let them talk to one another. Millie's expression was blank, then her eyebrows focused.
They can do that.
They are doing that. Mom connected when she brought Howard home. She came through the shop.
Ick, you made it sound like Howard was delivered like a baby.
He kind of is.
No.
Millie put her hands up.
Besides, if that machine room is connecting to the shop, why do I go up to the machine room every day? Why do I carry along this little book and fill it with little numbers?
Jules' first reaction was to say, don't you want to go into the shop? It would be ha-ha funny to him. But he felt their conversation was on the edge between sassy fun and irritable, if not irate teen. So he decided to diffuse some heat. Hopefully. You're doing the hard work, Millie. This computer doesn't know what it's looking at. You've actually found a lot more connections in the data than showed up on the link between the machine room and Howard. That seemed to cut a few steps out of the angry ladder. Millie's shoulders came down.
I don't like being used, she said.
Jules was surprised at the stark honesty.
How can I avoid causing you that feeling? Don't hide stuff like that from me. I'm not a setup to your punchline. Not everything has to be a big reveal to me. It's honestly getting tiring.
Jules had to sit with this thought for a minute. He looked at his hands. Then he talked to them. I honestly didn't think of this as being a slow reveal. I'm getting back into being in the shop and realizing how much there is. It's been a fast remembering to me. So if I'm filtering at a different speed, well, I appreciate you telling me, rather than thinking I'm purposefully hiding things to make you a punchline. He used his thumbnail to clear off a flake from the other thumbnail. Then he looked up at Millie. She was not giving away a particular emotion, much less appearing to fire up a wave of massive anger. If anything, Millie was looking softer than he'd seen her for a few weeks. I'm really trying to not. Jules stopped where he wanted to talk about hiding things from Millie, before he remembered that they had spent the last 13 years doing just that. It was honesty that was working here, so he added some more. We are really trying to move away from hiding things about the shop from you. It's going to take some time. I think you can see I'm doing better.
Okay.
Millie seemed to believe him. Anything else? Jules asked. Millie snorted.
Howard is creepy. The mighty blank would be a ninja,
you should aim more for ninja.
Fair, Jules thought. Very fair.
It was not a good day to walk back from school alone, even for the few blocks. Pats was nursing a cold. Reggie was grounded, hard this time. No phone, no devices, dropped off to and picked up from school, kind of locked down. Mrs. Taraskel waved Millie over and offered a ride, but was politely refused.
"It's overcast, chilly, and damp. Your father would rather you not get pneumonia."
"I'm really okay, but thank you," Millie waved back, skipping a little down the street.
When she was surely out of distance for a reasonable person like Mrs. Taraskel, and out of sight, too, Millie sneezed. It wasn't a cold, she was sure, just one of those ones that comes up ironically when somebody talks to you about being sick. Millie recovered and paced herself, getting home. It was chilly, but not really cold, damp, but not wet. Overcast, but not fully raining. It was actually warm enough for there to be other smells around besides just cold weather. All the snow had long gurgled down the storm drains, but there were little berms of crud in parking lots and street corners where the biggest piles had been. It wasn't flower time or even wet dirt time. Thank God it wasn't time for that smell to form out in front of the seafood bar. But the icy was passing enough that there was an actual aroma in the world. Millie skirted a large puddle formed in the recess of the sidewalk under an overhanging awning. She subconsciously alternated to avoid the falling streams. Inside the awning for one column of drips, outside for the next. Her thoughts followed the waving line. She was inside space. She was outside space. The doors to inside led outside. The doors outside led in. She stopped and looked around. Her brain felt that long edge of doom and infinity over which the world would be a scramble of shining space windows to terror and twisting realities of unknown horror. Surprisingly, there was no fear that appeared. Millie just saw an edge. In this, her neighborhood, on this slippery and gray day, Millie felt comfort. This was hers, and she was not alone, even though she was by herself. She felt home. She felt strong. She felt in her place enough comfort that she let her mind wander to admire that edge to frightening new places. Over the edge was madness. Here in her neighborhood, her mind felt safe enough to be calm.
"Something about that doesn't quite sound right," Millie said to herself. Thinking and being afraid were not madness. They were just thoughts.
Her thoughts, in her mind, she returned to them, to the twisting universe edge, and looked into the chasm. At the bottom, she saw the nameless, shadowy fear of an infinite dark pit. To her surprise, it wasn't really a chasm anymore. When the panic caught up with her in the market those months ago, the fear was shadowy and the pit was infinite and very dark. Not anymore. Now it looked remarkably like a whomping parking meter. Millie thought about Mom's words to Dad. "She doesn't know what she's afraid of," Mom had said. Millie let the things she'd seen run through her mind. Walking cities and fat pigeon cars. Brentone and Dalibertore. Even the machine room, both when it was crazy with information and silent, which was strangely scarier. She had real stuff to be afraid of, which was surprisingly less terrifying. The fear was no longer dark and nameless. At worst, it was some guy named Listing who just hated Mom and Dad.
No longer was life just a switch between ignorant serenity and nameless panic. Millie found comfort in knowledge, even when it was scary. Before she realized it, Millie had drifted into the apartment building landing. She felt calm and happy. They were at work. The dinner dishes were away. The books were open. Jules was talking with Millie and flipping between pages and a couple computers and tables that were spread between paper documents. Stoney half read a book in the living room, the other half eavesdropping. Jules was serving concepts using his professorial voice. The shop is not just a library or a door. The persistence engine is a combination of multiple parts that make it a powerful tool as it is. Millie asked a good question. How much power are we talking? I see these numbers, but they don't mean a lot in the real world. Like, is this like a bunch of phone batteries or the local power plant? Stoney thought for a second. The normal response when she wanted to answer was that the shop drew slightly more than one household's energy from each world across the network of tethers. When she didn't want to answer, she said the shop's power draw was a supersymmetrical equilibrium across multi-phase space-time. Most people stopped asking quickly after that, which was the point. Jules had a better explanation. If we're thinking about a light bulb like watts, the shop uses something like 30 watts, 30 followed by just about 25 zeros, about the energy of a regular star. Millie's delayed blinking was both audible and the appropriate reaction. Jules continued, "It's a hard answer because we connect to a lot of planets and each uses a different kind of energy. We don't want to take a lot from planets that are dumping soot to their air for electricity. They'll also notice. And there's some fuzzy math involving the speed of light and bank fees." "I don't think," Millie started to recover, "I don't think I ever put those numbers into real numbers. So if I switch them on this chart, it shows how much bigger the main shop is. The secret power draw is big, but like a fraction the size, and the little thing Mom called a hacker is very small." "Yes," Jules said, "and if you see, the two clusters are getting closer." "Either of them could either be doing just like one part of what the whole shop does." "Well, first, how many parts of the persistence engine do you think there are?" Jules was back into teaching mode. Stoney checked down the list in her own head and thought she could hear Millie making similar connections. Then her daughter spoke up. "There's six parts, aren't there? There are six main actions in the machine room." Stoney didn't underestimate her, but could still be surprised at how quick to recover and then continually observant Millie was. From across the room, she folded her book in her lap and listened fully. She heard Jules continue in teaching mode. "Want to name them?" he asked. Millie let a moment pass. "I think three of them are doing stuff. Tethering, moving, and, well, the printhead, which can get us in trouble." Millie said it, kind of rising as a joke. Stoney could hear the muscles in Jules' face trying to make a stern expression and failing. Millie continued. "The other three are storage, the library of information, the shop itself, like the shop floor. And I don't know what to call the third one, but it's kind of the machine room where the engine is, but it goes so much larger than just the persistence engine. Are those the names?" "The real names, Jules," Stoney called from across the room to inject a little fun into the proceeding. "What does she mean?" Millie asked. Stoney heard Joel's face muscles fight some more. Perfect. You were talking about the machine room mounting. I have referred to it as other things when it has been temperamental. Like what? Millie asked. Stoney smiled and picked her book back up. Millie's question about her origins still echoed around, even if Stoney was comfortable with her very present Earth-based perspective. There would be some time soon that she'd have to explore the complexities of that answer more deeply. In the meantime, she'd enjoy the novelty of paper-based physical books and sit in comfort that the shop was in the capable, if chaotic, hands of these two. It was a morning that the city came knocking for attention outside her window. Sometimes the neighborhood around the building did not say good morning until she walked outside the front door of the apartment building and greeted it first. Then there were other days where the raucous city followed them in from the night before and left its sight and sounds and smells throughout the apartment, filling their dreams and creeping from the late night into the dawn. When the restaurant two doors down Hudson Street caught fire, there were sirens that spent the entire night making the walls red and blue, and the scent of burning wood and fried French fries became stale over days afterwards. The same thing would happen when the festive noise and pencil shaving smell of a parade and fireworks trailed in on 4th of July or New Year's morning. But then there were days like these, where the pointy awareness of the city pierced the sweet cocoon of her bedroom without invitation. The world made its presence known from just a second after she woke up. It hadn't been so acute a presence to become a person in the waking moment, that second of dreaming that you remember when staring at the inside of your eyelids. Millie had a moment to enjoy the morning, the feeling of being awake, and a quick look at the messages on her phone before the shouting began outside on the street. It lasted long enough that curiosity got her, and Millie opened the drapes and looked out. She saw a crowd across the street and followed their gaze upwards. Oh, that's not good. She closed the drapes and walked down the hallway to find her father looking out the living room window. He winced when the shouts from the street got louder. Oh, he said, that's not good. Millie took a position next to her father to watch. The crowd she saw was still there, but quickly stepping backwards in a widening semicircle. They were stepping backwards from a potential point of impact. Do people still have pianos? Millie asked. Like, they have pianos that get moved? I thought they were part of the floor or something. There were cars on the street smaller than the instrument dangling out the sixth story across the street. Everything, from the trellis overhanging the roof to the pulleys at the trellis ends to the rope running from the pulleys down to the piano, stretched and strained. The piano strained too, whining in a low C sharp. No, honey, they're very real and honest pieces of furniture, heavy ones too. The one across the street descended another few feet before it descended a few more, much more quickly. The crowd took two collective steps backward with an ooh and didn't recondense. Expensive, too, Dad added. I'm not sure why someone wouldn't just carry a tablet, even a keyboard. Some people, Dad paused as the piano took a light twirl, just like pianos. They watched quietly for another story of descent. Quietly together, before Millie spoke. Is it okay that didn't feel like an important lesson you were trying to impart in this situation?
She heard Dad give a little snort. I guess it's been a lot of important lessons recently. No, this is just pretty cool to watch. Well, send good thoughts as they try to not crush the entire sidewalk of people.
The movers appeared to be getting themselves into a more even rhythm now, and the quick drops and long pauses of the descending monster became steadier.
Do you know where that piano is going?
Apparently, that place was a jazz club years ago. They're going to open some new restaurant up there, and I suppose someone wanted the old instrument.
Just above the first story, the piano paused, and the movers backed a truck up onto the sidewalk. Gently, the bulky monster drifted the last few feet before touching the truck bed. The rope slackened, and the suspension of the truck was tested. Everything paused, breaths held, the piano and the truck stayed without creaking or moving. The mover boss tentatively reached up and unhooked the main rope. It all stayed in one place. He turned around, gave a theatric bow to the crowd, who responded with first a released breath, then claps and cheers. Millie and Dad clapped from their box seats. Reggie had just one thought running through his brain. Spring break. He had served his punishment just in time to avoid a lot of tedious spring school nonsense, but still get out for the main event, a week off as the weather was getting nice. Mort and Delia Taraskel's punishments were honestly not awful, particularly for their second child. They were just involved, time-consuming, and usually missed the point. Reggie was pouring his excitement all over Pats, who was similarly happy to have a week off, but had no place in school where he could express it. And break was painfully close. Last two periods of school, even the teachers didn't want to be there, so it was art option time. They took the option to visit the library and the beanbag chairs therein, or would when Millie showed up. Reggie was laying out their assault on the video game Elving Gap. Both him and Pats got it for Christmas, but needed 3 months of grinding to get high enough for the new DLC.
So if you're over Tuesday, we only need to get through the Dark Hall level by Monday night. I'm not going to be able to play when I'm at your house. Mom put a hard 2-hour limit on my games for the break. I'm going to be down at Hudson Youth Club most of the day.
You can play at the club. They have Wi-Fi.
No, I can't. I'm working.
Pats saw his friend was confused.
I want to be a counselor this summer. This is the first step in the training.
Reggie was indignant.
You've got years to be a counselor. Why waste this spring break?
First, I like my counselors. Second, it's paid. Third, I like my counselors.
That had a startling effect on Reggie, who continued to process the concept of legitimate income when Millie rambled in. She flopped down on the third beanbag chair. Pats turned to her.
You okay?
Just wiped out. Ready for this break.
Right, Reggie exclaimed. We're doing Elving Gap this weekend.
Millie's restraint let way to express some mix of eating too much pizza and having air let out of a tire. It was a sound a lot of adults made around kids that made Millie sound like she was immediately exhausted of Reggie.
Or not, Reggie corrected. What are you thinking about?
He separated each word, trying to avoid saying something wrong.
It's not you. I'm still helping Grandpa. I'd love to run around the neighborhood, just not video game mode. We could do a movie.
She turned to Pats.
After Hudson Youth?
Half Price Tuesdays, Pats answered.
Reggie felt his spring break plan evaporating, but didn't fully mind, because it was still not the tedium of Tarascal Penitentiary. They sat in their little circle between the poetry and biography sections. If you leaned one way, the rows of books scattered into zigzag patterns. The other way, everything snapped into alignment. There were a few other clusters of students who took the art time to visit the library. He was certain there wasn't a ton of art happening in either of the other classrooms. Reggie didn't particularly like long quiets, but with these two, it felt okay. Pat's had a thick, hardbound graphic novel he was working through. Reggie had his own e-reader with a couple books on it, nothing too difficult. He worked on the same page for a fifth time. He looked at Millie, who was writing out a long table of numbers, which was odd because it wasn't a drawing. It was a notebook that didn't look like Millie's regular drawing pads, but she was just as intent in putting pencil to paper. "Is that long math exam what's taking your video game energy?" Reggie asked Millie. Millie didn't look up from her notepad. It was kind of the same as when she was intent on doing a drawing, but her face didn't look as relaxed. There was something hard in these numbers, something beyond just a dumb math problem. They went back to their settled reading cohort. Reggie finished his page, then the next, then the chapter. He drew out of the story for a second and listened in the library. He heard two other clusters of kids, close enough to the max library noise level that it was evident they were sharing videos on their phones. He heard a teacher in the hall making rounds to prevent escapees from getting a jump on the holiday. He heard the big mechanical clock tick closer to dismissal. He didn't hear Millie or Pat's ready to engage in conversation. Might as well get another chapter in, which he did. It was Pat's that made the next sound as he closed up the large comic he was reading. He sat there for a moment before picking up his phone and starting to type. "You okay?" Reggie asked. "That was intense. Mark's legions were never supposed to leave the Belted Island, but they did, and Amity was forced to track them down, just one by one. The way they had come in was..." And he trailed off. Pat's looked shaken, typing quickly. Reggie gave up his own book. "For real?" Pat's was finally putting down the phone. "You need to read this one." A different kind of popping energy erupted from the third chair. "No, it's no," Millie rumbled, before descending into a series of exasperated grunts. The boys shared a look of surprise, then turned to their friend. "Want to share?" Pat's asked. "Can't," Millie said, rubbing her eyes. "Life." Reggie asked the most important question. "Is that going to take up a lot of your break?" "No, it won't. It shouldn't. It can't." Millie let out a long breath. She shook her head. "It shouldn't. We feel so close to some answers. They're getting weird, so it's like a moving target the closer we get. But it's just numbers." Reggie was flippant. "You know, looking at something changes it." Millie stopped. "What did you say?" She switched between looking at Reggie, looking at her book, and looking back at Reggie. There was a draining expression, startling Reggie to forgetting what he actually had said. He put up both hands and gave a small shrug. Pat's had heard and saw Millie's expression. "If you look at something, you change it," he said slowly. "It was the plot of the Effervescent comic a few stories ago. They kept trying to catch a quantum burglar." He trailed off as they watched all the math and work and expressions flood over Millie as a triple-time movie projected on her face. "Oh, no." At that point, the bell rang to dismiss school. The hallway was a train tunnel as the first kid out of class ran full speed emitting a max volume scream down the corridor, hit the door, and continued to their spring break. Millie left almost as quickly. Just about running, too. It drained Reggie of his own impetus to dash out of the building. Man, she was ready for break. I think breakthrough is more like it. Reggie was deeply confused. What do you mean? Reggie felt Pat studying him for a second, then say, life. The shop was acting weird. That's what she's been trying to figure out. Haven't you caught it? Pat sighed. If it has something to do with changing stuff by seeing it, I hope she doesn't think she did something wrong or feel guilty or anything. Reggie puckered his lips, then tried to think how any of this information would have come into his brain. He had to wear the dumb mask that Pat's usually reserved for the Hawks math class. The bigger boy laughed, newly bigger boy, and patted his friend on the back, prompting them out of the room. Honestly, Reggie, you should pay more attention. This was Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop, Chapter 17, A Good Month of Hard Work. In the next episode, we find out what Millie has discovered about the power draining the shop. Thank you for listening. You can find more about Millie at milliesalmon.com or join us on Patreon. Please like, subscribe, and leave a review on whichever podcast app you use. Millie Salmon and the Infinite Shop is a production of Infinite Shop Limited, which you can follow on all social media platforms. I'm Ray Dubicki. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to reading some more for you soon.